WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Joyce Johnson met Jack Kerouac in January of 1957 when she was 21. For the next 2 years, they were lovers, although much of that time Kerouac was on the road while Johnson remained home in New York. In her 1983 memoir, Minor Characters, Johnson wrote about being a woman on the periphery of a circle of male beat writers. The memoir won a National Book Critics Circle Award. Johnson is now a contributing editor at Vanity Fair magazine and a former editor at Dial Press and Atlantic Monthly Books. At the end of Minor Characters, she briefly describes her life in the years immediately following her relationship with Kerouac. She explains that in her mid-20s, she fell deeply in love and married James Johnson. Soon after that, he died in a motorcycle accident. James Johnson is the model for the character of Tom Murphy in Joyce Johnson's new novel, In the Night Cafe. Set in the early 60s, the novel is about Joanna Gold, who has left her middle-class background to live a bohemian life, and Tom Murphy, a talented but struggling painter. Like the Johnson marriage, their marriage is ended by a fatal motorcycle accident. I asked Joyce Johnson to read a passage in which Joanna Gold describes the pleasure and danger of riding on the motorcycle with Tom.
I remember hurtling out over the Brooklyn Bridge in astonishing rushes of cold air, the steel beneath our wheels singing its one long high note, and the highways that took us out of the city, all ablaze the farther we went, red, yellow, red, yellow. For a while you could fill your mind up with those colors. Or with the roadbed beneath us, which had to be watched so carefully, all those patches of things that could have done us in, oil slick or sand, spills of gravel, the shiny places that were wet when we came up on them fast. We kept saying we had to buy helmets, but we never did. I was always freezing, trying to warm myself, my breast bruised into you, skidding on the blue nylon of your jacket. I got to know the back of your neck by heart, the places where your hair grew thickest and curled a little. You smell brown, I remember whispering into your ear, when we'd stop for a light in some town in Westchester. I'd close my eyes and hold you even tighter when you speeded us down that narrow path between the lanes of cars. Death Alley, it was called, like the avenue in your old neighborhood. On the roads, I'd see other couples clenched in the same embrace. This was how we looked, too, I'd tell myself, surprised. Daring and fatal. I would never have been the girl on the buddy seat if it hadn't been for you. Motorcycle riders would salute each other, holding their right palms up against the wind. It was always done so solemnly that at first it made me want to laugh. Then I began to think maybe we did all belong to the same thing. A secret society traveling the lanes cars wouldn't dare to enter, coming out in our machines to burn up time. Now it seems crazy that I came to be so unthinking, accepting the danger of those rides the way I accepted the cold. Being like you, I used to feel, instead of like me. Didn't we move out there as if we were one body? I was sure that if we died, we'd die together. But how could we die when we were so alive?
Do you remember feeling that way on a bicycle?
Yeah, I do. I do remember feeling exactly that way. I remember the absolute thrill of those rides and the feeling of being totally located in the moment.
On the other hand, I got the feeling that you felt like you didn't really belong on a motorcycle.
Well, it was something I never would have I never would have done if I hadn't been married to the man I was married to, who was a person who lived his life in terms of taking risks. I'm a more cautious person by nature.
Well, I like that line in there about this is what I'd call being like you instead of being like me.
Yeah.
Was that a hard thing to figure out when you were very close with someone who was really different from you? What instincts were really his and which were yours? And which should you follow?
Well, you know, like a lot of young women, I craved adventure. And in a way, knowing certain men brought me close to certain kinds of adventures. For example, when I knew Kerouac, I could never... I was not a person who could myself at that time go on the road, but I felt close to that experience, hearing Kerouac talk about it and write about it, too. I always wanted to go on the road with him. And in a sense, the motorcycle was a kind of on-the-road experience for me.
Well, this is reminding me of something that you'd said in an interview several years ago after Minor Characters, when I interviewed you, and this really stuck with me. You said that men during that period in the 50s and early 60s had adventures. And for women, their female counterparts, the adventures were frequently having relationships with the men who had adventures.
That's true. That's true. I think it's still true to some extent.
Did you ever want those adventures for yourself? Did you ever consider going on the road?
I fantasize about those adventures, but as I say, I was a cautious person. I was sort of aware of the risks, you know, in my own way, as a very young woman living in the village and hanging out in the circles, I hung out and I took certain risks, certainly a lot of emotional risks. I think those were the kinds of risks I took.
Well, you also had a lot of lovers, at least I assume that from the novel. You know, in The Night Cafe, the character says it was 1962. In 3 years, I'd had 14 lovers. Sex was really an adventure, and was it, in its own way, for women as risky as going out on the road? There were a lot of hazards involved.
And in the days before, you know, really good birth control, it was a little bit like Russian roulette.
Mm-hmm. Well, you had to have an abortion, didn't you?
That's right. That's right.
Was it dangerous?
Yes. Well, it was. I was lucky because I went to a real doctor, but the surrounding circumstances were very kind of scary and sleazy, but it turned out okay.
Joyce Johnson is my guest, and her new novel is called In the Night Cafe. Tom, the painter in this new novel, and Jack Kerouac, who you were very close to for about a year, were both artists. And the main woman character in your new novel, and yourself in your memoir about your time with Kerouac, both felt that they hadn't found themselves yet, that they hadn't found their work yet. That they were with a man who had a very strong sense of his work, but that the woman hadn't found hers. When you were experiencing that, was that very hard to go through? Of being with someone who was so sure of their work and being not sure you'd found yours?
It was a hard thing to go through, and it had something to do with the time that I found myself in. I think, you know, 6 or 7 years later, things began to change very much for women. But in 62, just as it had been in the late 1950s, there really wasn't much interest or support when it came to women themselves wanting to produce art. Nobody took it seriously. Nobody was very interested. It was a very kind of lonely enterprise. In my own case, I did publish a first novel when I was very young, when I was 26 years old. This was in 1962, and this was before I met my first husband, and it was really a sense of publishing into a terrible void. I remember one review that I got, which is sort of typical the kinds of reviews that a young woman would get in those days if she managed to publish something. There was a person in the Herald Tribune called Talia Farrow Boatwright who referred to me in the review as a concise little miss.
Oh, horrible. Well, was Jack Kerouac or your first husband supportive of your writing?
Both were actually very supportive of me. Both encouraged me to work, and what I was really struggling with was the feeling of a kind of larger disinterest in what I was doing.
You know, something I really love about your books is that they're stories that prove that you ultimately found your calling in writing. You know, they're stories in which the woman is typing to make a living, supporting these artists, wondering, like, will she ever find her own work? And you do, and the novel and the memoir that describes this prove it. I just find that very exciting.
Well, of course, while you're very engaged in living, you're also accumulating things that you may later write about.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't, you know, those times weren't wasted.
In a way, I think you loved two self-destructive artists. I mean, the character of Tom, who's based on your husband, comes off as reasonably self-destructive, and Kerouac certainly had his self-destructive instincts. Do you agree with that?
Yes. I didn't love them because they were self-destructive.
Mm-hmm. But I think that makes a relationship a lot more problematic.
But it does make things. It was very. Both relationships were very intense. But I wanted to, I believed that somehow everything would work out, that love would sort of save the day, that what these people needed was to be loved, and then that would overcome their histories. But people can't overcome their histories very well most of the time.
I was wondering if even when they were at their most self-destructive and most selfish, if one of the things that would often keep you going would be their work, seeing something really extraordinary in their work that you knew came from them and that you'd continue loving in them no matter what they were going through.
I think that's very true. I did feel that. I felt there was a connection to this intense, painful feeling that they had and what came out in their work. Certainly in Kerouac's work, over and over again, one is aware of his pain and of his sense of mortality and of how short life is, and that's what gives it his work its special quality. It's all infused with that sense. And I had somewhat the same sense about my husband's paintings, which were all done in a kind of frenzy. They'd be done very quickly. They'd work or they wouldn't work. If they worked, they remained on the wall. If they didn't work, they went on the floor. And being a writer, and of actually a very slow, painstaking writer, I was really jealous in a way of seeing those big swashes of paint go across the canvas and something being there so quickly.
It's funny to me, when you were living a very bohemian life, you were supporting yourself and frequently supporting the men who you lived with by typing, by working as a secretary in various places.
That's right, yeah.
As your main character does in your novel In the Night Cafe. There's a passage I'd really like for you to read about that.
Okay, just a second. In those days, I was a crackerjack typist, 100 WPM. I typed envelopes, theses, just about everything. I'd stick cards up all over the village. Speed of light satisfaction. No job too big or too small. If I ran out of clients, I'd be a Kelly girl and go around to various offices. I didn't mind that too much because it was interesting to work in different parts of the city. I'd eat a tuna fish sandwich at my desk and walk around in my lunch hour learning about places like Varick Street and Coenties Slip. I could usually type faster than any of the other secretaries, and sometimes they'd ask me to stay on permanently. I'd say no, I didn't want a regular job. It was because of the acting. I always had to leave an opening for it. But also, I was afraid. Afraid offices would get me, and I wouldn't be free anymore. I'd somehow be stuck in a role I'd never meant to choose. An office girl who wore nylons all through the hot weather, and a dictation pad on her knee. When I wanted so much more for myself, when my real life hadn't even started. As a Kelly girl, I saw things I didn't like in other people's offices, tyrannies, cruelties. But the beauty of being a Kelly girl was that none of that had to do with me. I could walk out and go to acting class, hang out with artists at the Cedar. I could tell Kelly girls to send me to a different job. I was temporary. I had no stake in any office.
Did you do a lot of that yourself?
I did some of that. I actually had a series of fairly steady jobs for... It worked better in this novel to make Joanna an office temporary.
Well, I remember in Jack Kerouac's letters, he used to refer to you as my little secretary in long black stockings.
That's true.
And also, you had when you were in your early 20s, you had been offered an editorial assistant position, a promotion from your secretarial position at a publishing company. But you turned that down because Kerouac had just invited you to join him in Mexico.
That's right. I thought that was my opportunity to go on the road. I was ready.
And what happened?
Well, he went to Mexico City and became ill there, and there was an earthquake. And as very often happened on Jack's trips, he would go to a place with full of hope, and then the place would suddenly accumulate bad vibes, and he'd feel that he'd have to leave. And that's exactly what happened. So instead of staying in Mexico City, he sent me a letter that he was on his way to New York. And so he came up to New York.
So you never made it on the road with him?
I never made it on the road with him.
What about that job offer? What happened with that?
I had turned that offer down and said, no, really, my plans have changed. I'm going to meet Jack Kerouac in Mexico City. And I left that job. But I had just sold my first novel and gotten half the advance, which was $500, which in 1957 was actually an enormous sum. I could imagine living on that for several months, and I did, in fact.
Did you ever have any regrets about turning down that job?
No, I don't think so. No.
Kerouac, when you were with him, had all these road experiences to write about, and you were living with him at the time when On the Road was published. Did you ever say to yourself, well, what will I have to write about? What big experiences will I have?
Yes, of course I would think about that. But I was a different kind of writer than Jack. And I, you know, one of my great models actually was Henry James, because I was always very interested in relationships and the nuances of relationships. And I knew that that would be my subject.
Did that ever feel like an obsolete kind of writing when people were doing, you know, bop prosody?
No, I don't. I think that subject matter is always important.
Well, I agree, but I was wondering if you were convinced of that at the time.
Well, bop prosody was something I admired very much, but knew I couldn't do myself. It wasn't me. I had a pretty distinct sense of what it was that I did, and I felt that ultimately I would do it very well. And, you know, if I just kept at it.
Let me ask you about another theme in your new novel, and that is the theme of men who abandon their wife and children. The husband in this book is a victim of that. His father left him when he was born, basically.
Right.
And then the husband, in his first marriage, does the same thing. He walks out on his son. And then the main character, the woman in this novel, later marries another man who walks out on their child. As a matter of fact, before we discuss this theme, let me ask you to read a paragraph about this marriage.
Mikkel's studio seemed wonderfully Parisian to me until after Nikki was born. It was an open 17th century attic. Mikkel wouldn't spoil it by putting up a wall. It had a romantic little balcony. You could step right out onto it and see chimneys and silver flashes of the Seine between rooftops. But there was no running water. Buckets had to be carried from a tap 3 flights down. I used to think if we'd had a wall or two or American plumbing, our marriage might have lasted longer. Mikkel greatly admired Nikki, but he left him entirely to me. The soft spot on babies' heads alarmed him. He'd pick Nikki up as if he were made of glass.
Was this an incapability of many men that you knew, the incapability of really being fathers?
At that time, I think it was very sort of difficult for many men to be fathers. There's much more sort of consciousness of the father's role, I think, right now, which is a very, very good, healthy thing. But still, there are fathers who are absent in one way or another. I teach an autobiography class at Columbia, and the whole theme of the absent father comes up over and over again in the work of my students, many of whom are, you know, products of broken marriages, or the fathers are present but absent in some way, unreachable, not there in some way for their children. And actually, that whole theme of absent fathers is the real organizing principle of this novel, which you guessed very accurately.
Did you accept this in the men that you knew, in a sense of, well, men are like that, they can't be tied down, and they don't want to be part of a family?
Well, I had had a very different experience as a child. My father was there and was a fairly devoted father. What I became aware of was that for men like Tom Murphy in my novel, who'd been abandoned by their own fathers, the ramifications carried over not only into their lives and the lives of their children, but into the lives of the women they married and so on. It sort of was a thing that ran through generations.
As a writer, you keep going back to the 1950s and early 1960s. Do you feel that that is your period?
It was a period that I found intensely rich and interesting and exciting and dramatic. It was certainly the most dramatic period of my life. So I have gone back to it in two books. I don't know that I will continue this in the future.
Who are you still in touch with from that period in your life?
Mainly Hetty Jones.
Who you dedicate your new novel to.
Who I dedicate my new novel to.
And you knew her at the time when she married Leroy Jones.
That's correct, yes.
Do you think of her as having had a lot of similar experiences with you, as you? In other words, becoming romantically involved with a man who was, you know, a rising star in the bohemian scene and having your work take a back seat to it.
Yes, we've had somewhat parallel experiences. Right now in the Village Voice Literary Supplement, there is, I think, a very sort of misguided article on Beat Women, which mentions me and also mentions Hetty. And it's that sort of kind of boring perception, writing beat women off as passive. What the writer, Alex Kate Shulman, doesn't really understand is that at the time, which was the late 50s and early 60s, the really big struggle for young women was just getting away from home, mm-hmm. you know, getting out in the world, getting a place to live, having some sexual experience, becoming self-supporting. All those things were new then for women to do. Now we sort of expect our young women to do all those things. But then, not only wasn't expected, it was also censured by families and by society. It was very, very tough, and it was such a struggle to do that much that there wasn't time, in a way, to transform relationships with men. It wasn't the moment when we could even think about that. And we did sort of forge a path for women who came after us by having some kind of independent life. We viewed ourselves as independent. I mean, we often, of course, not only took care of ourselves, but of the men we were involved with.
Writer and editor Joyce Johnson is my guest. You have a recent article in the January edition of Fame magazine. It was about going back to Kerouac's hometown where a memorial in his honor was being unveiled. I think at this memorial gathering, there were several of Kerouac's former wives.
That's true, yes.
What's it like when you all get together? I mean, you and he weren't married, but had a fairly long relationship.
Well, the people at the gathering were Edie Parker, who was his first wife, and I also got to know Jack's daughter Jan pretty mm-hmm. well through going to that thing at Lowell, and we're all very, very friendly with each other, and we, you know, Edie and I have talked a lot over the years and swapped experiences and gotten to, you know, increased our own understanding of the kind of person Jack was. Jack's third wife, however, Stella Kerouac, who's the executor of his estate, has remained aloof from everybody else, and not only ex-wives and girlfriends, but friends of Jack's, and that remained true during the time that everybody was at Lowell.
So has that made it hard to get access to certain letters of his or other personal documents that someone would consider using in writing a memoir about him or a biography?
Well, Stella Kerouac's position is that she doesn't want anything more by Jack Kerouac published during her lifetime, and I don't know quite what the reason for that is, but it makes it enormously difficult, I think, for say, biographers to do a really authoritative job because they can't quote from any of Jack's letters. He was a wonderful letter writer, and I myself had many letters from him. When I came to write my memoir, Minor Characters, I discovered that I was not going to be allowed to quote from any of these letters, which I'd had in my possession for years and years.
Do you think it's selfish to do that?
I think it's selfish. I think it's certainly not what Kerouac would have wished. Kerouac was a writer who was very kind of conscious of his place in history and who very carefully kept up his archives. I mean, his life may have been very chaotic, but he saved all kinds of writings and letters and so on, and I wonder what's happened to those archives. Those archives may very well include some very interesting unpublished manuscripts, but certainly his letters are quite remarkable and would be worth publishing, would be valuable reading for many people.
You've been an editor for many years now?
That's right.
How did you become an editor?
I went to work after I got out of Barnard College, where I'd been an English major, and being an English major, I wanted to get into publishing. My first jobs were in a couple of literary agencies, but then I began to work in publishing houses. In those days, a young woman could be a secretary practically forever. Things have really changed. But as a secretary, you could allow yourself to be exploited and take manuscripts home and do some editing without being called editor. So finally, I sort of worked my way up, and when I was at William Morrow and Company, I actually began to acquire books because friends of mine were writing some interesting books. And so I finally said, well, you know, why don't you call me an editor since that's what I'm doing? And they agreed to, and then I became a real editor after that. And the editing was very absorbing and satisfying work for me, although for many years that I was editing, I did no writing of my own.
When you were with Kerouac at the time that he was becoming famous, you had seen some publishers reject his work because I didn't really understand it. Did that make you a more committed editor yourself, more committed to trying to penetrate things that on first reading might seem strange to you?
Yes, I was very determined to try to see that certain works that other publishers might consider unacceptable got into print. During the late 60s and the 70s, I was very concerned with publishing books on civil rights. I published Abbie Hoffman's first book, Revolution for the Hell of It, and a whole lot of other stuff of that kind.
You know, at the end of both Minor Characters and your new novel In the Night Cafe, I was left with this question: will this woman ever find the same kind of passion and commitment that she's found in the story that I've just read? And I guess I want to ask you that question because I've left both of these books set in the 50s and 60s thinking, well, is that it? Is that the height of passion in the life?
For me, I think it certainly was, as my life worked out. I've gone on to actually, you know, find satisfaction in other things with my relationship with my son, with you know, long-lasting good friendships with people, and also, of course, in my relationship with my work, which is my real work, which is writing, which has come to take a larger and larger place in my life. In the last few years, for the first time, I've been able to become a full-time writer, and that feels very good to me.
Do you regret that there isn't that same level of passion now, or do you just accept that that's the way it is?
I just accept that that's the way it is. No one goes on into another state of being, I guess.
Okay. I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you.